This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my blessing to be in dialogue with Dr. Juliette Hooker. She is Royce Family Professor of Teaching Excellence in Political Science at Brown University. We will be discussing her newly published book, Black Grief, White Grievance, The Politics of Loss, published in Princeton by Princeton University Press, 2023. Juliette, it's my absolute honor and privilege to be in dialogue with you today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here and to be talking about Black grief and white grievance.
To begin, can you kindly tell us about yourself? Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life catalyzed the scholar you would become as an adult?
Yeah, so I grew up on the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua in Central America in the 1970s and 1980s when the country was going through a civil war. And, you know, the part of Nicaragua that I'm from is the region that has a significant Black population that has historically lived in that region and in conjunction with indigenous peoples. And so I think because of the history of where, you know, of the Caribbean coast and the sort of struggles over whether they were, you know, we were seen as Nicaraguan or not, and how we differed from some of the dominant ways in which people thought about Nicaraguan national identity, that I started thinking about questions of race and racial identity and nationalism, and also just thinking about, you know, how racism manifests itself in Latin America. And then I moved to the U.S. and had lived here more than half my life now. And so I've also thought about, you know, the question of how to think about the U.S. and Latin America together, which has been a big theme in my scholarship, and also thinking about what racial justice would entail. And then after, particularly after I came to the U.S., you know, becoming more well-versed and drawing on African-American thinkers and Black political thought more generally. I mean, that has been a focus of my scholarship.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to readers?
So I started writing the book after the Ferguson protests in 2015. And like many people, you know, I was horrified by what was happening, by the ways in which, you know, this outpouring of Black grief was being met with such a militarized and violent police response. And so I started writing an essay that became chapter 2 in the book, which is this essay about the history of Black protests and how to think about the movement for Black lives and in relation to that and the ways in which people have reacted to it, both trying to discipline it and also, you know, arguing that it departs from previous, you know, iconic forms of activism, such as the civil rights movement. And then in 2016, of course, you had the you know, Donald Trump's presidential campaign with the sort of racism, misogyny, anti-immigrant rhetoric. And so I started thinking about how there was this very palpable mobilization of white grievance that was happening simultaneously as you had people mobilizing around Black grief. And so really that was the sort of impetus for the book, is saying, you know, these two things are happening together at the same time. And we need to be able to think about together what's a framework that helps us to think about why people are mobilizing in these ways. And you know, the subsequent, you know, 2020 racial justice protests after the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, followed by the insurrection on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, just kind of reinforced the sense that that these were two of the Black grief and white grievance were two of the driving forces in contemporary racial politics in the United States.
What are the primary themes in your book? What message does your book convey to readers?
So the book is primarily concerned with how citizens mobilize in response to loss, right? So so thinking about the ways in which people in the United States, because it's concerned with the examples that I draw upon are primarily from the history of the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. It looks at the ways in which there's been a very unequal distribution of loss in the United States, right? So Black citizens have had to bear loss repeatedly and are expected to protest in only the most heroic ways, whereas whites have historically been more insulated from loss because they have been the dominant group politically, economically, socially. And so part of what the book is trying to do is to look at this history and to say, how is that shaping current threats to US democracy? And in particular, one of the things that I argue is that we often worry about so-called Black rioting or Black anger, but that the gravest threat to US democracy right now is white grievance.
How does your book recontextualize the legacies of the Obama and Trump presidencies?
So I think one of the mistakes that we often make, or at least, in a lot of the media discussion of Trump is seeing him as a kind of aberration. And I think part of what I do in this book is to say he's not an anomaly. We are living in a moment of sort of resurgent white grievance, but white grievance is not new. And that you can go back to periods such as the period following Reconstruction, and you see how Black gains are followed by racist backlash. And you see that in the 1960s as well, after the civil rights victories. But more recently, right, we have to see Trump and Obama as really one is a reaction to the election of the other, right? So that Obama's election was experienced by some as a loss, as a moment in which whites were displaced from the center of U.S. political life. You know, that led, of course, to the Tea Party, to the take our slogans, which is "Let's take our country back." And I think that this then continued and it exacerbated with Trump's presidency and since his loss in 2020. And now you have, a significant part of the country, of the Republican Party, that's really consumed by racial resentment and by these kind of cultural losses that and seeking to really I think dispense with democracy when it means that they are not able to win fairly in electoral contests.
How does your study advance our understanding of loss?
So the book is really trying to think about political loss, right? And loss is a universal human experience. We all have lost someone or something. We do so throughout our lives. But by political loss, I'm thinking about losses that are losses that we have to attend to as democratic citizens. And one of the things that, that I think we need to think about here when we think about political loss is the ways in which loss captures these elements that aren't simply just grief or grievance or sorrow, but exceeds or harm or injury, right? And so part of what I'm doing in the book in particular actually is saying that when we think about political loss, we have much to learn from looking at African-American thinkers as exemplary theorists of loss, which we haven't necessarily turned to them for those insights. And I think one of the great virtues of the tradition in this regard is that African-American thinkers did not have the luxury of being sort of nostalgic thinkers, right? Ida B. Wells has been described as being fiercely anti-nostalgic. She's one of the African-American thinkers I write about in the book. And I think this is an apt way to describe the tradition more generally, right? That there's no moment in the past that African-American thinkers could turn to as a moment where there was greater racial egalitarianism, but they also could have not been able to be, naive or sanguine about the future because, the struggles they knew for racial justice would outlive them. And so one of the things that I argue in the book that I think is really important is that they show us a way to approach loss that is able to deal with contingency, with vulnerability, rather than having the response to loss be doubling down on the desire for domination in order to not experience loss. And so I think there's part of what I'm hoping that the book will do is really help us to think about loss by sitting with these thinkers and taking them seriously as theorists of loss.
Can you tell us about the Save Our Sons and Daughters movement, the anti-violence organization of Black parents that emerged in Detroit in the 1980s? Why is it significant?
Yeah, so SAD, that's the acronym for their name, is a really fascinating example because it's an organization that emerges in Detroit. It's founded by an activist named Clementine Barfield after one of her sons is killed and another is permanently injured as a result of gun violence. And she was already an activist, and then she creates, she founds this organization that's really an organization of parents who have lost children to gun violence, and it becomes eventually mostly mothers, but it's really it includes fathers as well, and the work that they did was really this work to try to to rethink the way in which the deaths of their children were being seen, right? So some of the children who were killed were their deaths were dismissed because they weren't seen as innocent victims, because let's say they might have been involved in some kind of illicit activity. And part of what SOSAD did in its activism was say, we need to care for all children, and we need to care. We need to find ways to affirm the lives of our children beyond violence and death. And so I turn to it in the book as an example of what I call grieving activism, right? This way in which, you know, activism is both a way to continue to grieve their children, but it's also a way, you know, their activism is really about trying to change the conditions that led to the death of their children.
What does the poet,
and of other children.
What does the poet Claudia Rankine mean by suggesting that the condition of Black life is one of mourning?
So she wrote this after, you know, thinking after, you know, a number of the incidents of the of racist violence, you know, the killing of Trayvon Martin, the mother Emmanuel Church massacre in Charleston, and part of what I think she's trying to say by saying that is to say, you know, because Black life is still so precarious, it's you know, because it can be still taken away in an instant by, you know, a total stranger who walks into your church and wants to foment a race war and just kills a number of people, or in the case of Trayvon Martin, right, you're going to a store to get some Skittles and you know, and somebody ends up gunning you down, that there is this way in which I think what she's trying to say is both that death is ever present and is always a, you know, is always a threat, but also that the losses that Black people have had to suffer have been so continuous that, you know, that mourning is a constant feature of Black life.
What are the similarities and differences in the meanings of the term loss, the term harm, the term grief, and the term grievance? Are they interchangeable? Can you clarify what you mean by each term?
This is a great question. So, so one of the things that I argue in the book, in Black Grief, White Grievance, is that we need to think about loss as more than, let's say, just harm or injury, which is often how we think about it, right? So there are these other dimensions to loss that aren't captured by saying, you know, a wrong was done to me, that there are these aesthetic and affective dimensions to loss that that are really central to it, and that exceed kind of this model of, you know, someone, you know, harmed me or injured me in some way. And so that's one of the ways in which I think we can think about this distinction, right? So Frederick Douglass writes in his autobiography about how, one of his autobiographies about how years after his escape from slavery, he only had to hear a slave spiritual to be, you know, transported back, as it were, to the plantation, and that there was such great sorrow that those slave spirituals would evoke in him, you know, in years, decades after he had escaped slavery. And so this is part of what I mean by saying that loss has these affective dimensions, that it's something that is not easily contained. You know, grief can come up at any moment, but it's also not just grief, because I'm thinking here not just about individual human experiences, but about political loss. And for me, grief and grievance are two responses to loss, right? So people, you suffer a loss and you can respond by grieving it, by, you know, experiencing sorrow, or you can respond by feeling like it was the result of a harm or an injury, and then you mobilize, right? You move to grievance, you engage in activism to gain redress for that harm. So grief and grievance, I think, are two responses to loss. And loss is more than just harm or injury.
Can you tell us about the significance of Erica Garner's death?
Absolutely. So I write about Erica Garner's death at the beginning of chapter 4, which is the chapter on Black maternal grief in the book. And I use her as an entry point, her life, for thinking about the cost of the kind of grieving activism that that so many Black people have engaged in, right? I talked about grieving activism in the case of So Sad. So Garner was also, of course, propelled into activism by the killing of her father, Eric Garner, by the NYPD. And she became, a very prominent activist in the wake of his death. And then she dies tragically at a very young age, shortly after giving birth. And so her death really points to these less spectacular ways in which Black people are also dying and are also being killed that we pay less attention to than, let's say, instances of police violence. She died because she suffered a heart attack and her heart was already enlarged. And then she gave birth, and Black women have some of the highest rates of maternal mortality in the United States. And so part of what I'm trying to think about by writing about her in that chapter is, right, the ways in which we laud people, right? She was described as a warrior for social justice. We laud their activism. We see them as heroes, but we don't pay attention to the fact that Erica Garner was also grieving, right? That she had suffered this enormous loss that she was trying to contend with at the same time as she had to become an activist. And also, and the other point that I think is really important about thinking about Erica in relation to her father, the death of her father, her death and the death of her father, is the way in which we pay more attention to these spectacular instances of violence than we do maybe to some of the more ordinary ways in which people continue to be killed by disparities in health, by just the cost of having to live in a racist society that, you know, that isn't necessarily something that has to be, that is going to manifest itself in being killed by the police, but manifests itself in the sort of wear and tear on the body, what we now call weathering, that comes from dealing with discrimination.
Can you comment on the significance of Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, the work by Harriet Jacobs?
Absolutely. So I write about Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl in chapter 3, which looks at the work of Jacobs and Ida B. Wells. And what I'm trying to think about in that chapter is this, the ways in which there is extra work that marginalized people need to do to make their losses visible, right? So there, we all know there are disparities in care and concern for the losses of different groups. And so for groups who aren't necessarily a priority, there's all of this extra work that goes into trying to make their losses visible so that they can be attended to. But there are costs that come with this process of trying to make loss visible, right? There are risks, because you might risk, for example, offering up Black pain or Black suffering in the service of generating white empathy. But at what point does that, you know, become this kind of problematic bargain where you have to show up, you know, you have to present these pain Black bodies all of the time in order to try to shock people into some kind of solidarity? And also, what are the, you know, what are the ways in which this is, you know, can become dehumanizing in and of itself, right? What are the ways in which you end up just revealing these or having to see Black people as only, right, defined by suffering? And so in this chapter, I talk about the how Jacobs and Wells try to balance grief and grievance, right? How they try to tell the stories of Black suffering without only focusing on Black death, but also focusing on Black life. And Incidents is a key text in that discussion, because in it, you know, Jacobs makes a lot of really interesting moves. So she, for example, is really clear about sexual violence in slavery, but she never gives us, you know, a very explicit rape scene, for example. She also attends to Black life. She gives us all of these examples of how Black people care for each other and manage to form bonds, even against the attempts to separate them, and that this loving, caring community that they manage against all odds to create is what sustains her and other enslaved people, even as they're suffering these unimaginable harms, right? And she talks about her struggles to try to not just become free, but to care for her children, and the struggles of other enslaved women, and the ways in which slavery, creates this kind of maternal ambivalence, because, you know, what does it mean to bring a child into that institution? So Incidents, I think, is really a fascinating text. And when we look at what Jacobs is doing in the text, we see her, on the one hand, calling on her white readers to reject slavery, but also being really strategic about what she's willing to offer up about Black suffering in order to mobilize the white public.
Can you tell us about the 1917 essay by Ida B. Wells, The East St. Louis Massacre, The Greatest Outrage of the Century? Can you elaborate on its importance?
Yes. So again, this is that same chapter, and this is one of the texts by Wells that I think shows the same kind of care that and the commitment to depicting not just anti-Black violence, to depicting Black people not simply as victims of violence, but to depicting them in their full humanity. And it, you know, and the Wells's account of the East St. Louis Massacre is really such an interesting text, because the East St. Louis Massacre is this essentially this white riot where you had these tensions, having to do with you know, kind of unionization and white and Black workers, and it sort of erupts into this essentially this like white race riot that leads to the killing and essentially displacement of thousands of Black people. And Wells travels from her home, you know, she was then living in Chicago. She travels to St. Louis, and she ends up going on this truck with this Red Cross truck with these Black women who had been displaced from their homes. And she follows them around and records their stories as they try to save whatever possessions they can. And one of the things that you see in all of these stories is like these wealth of details about their lives. So, you know, so she talks about, you know, what they did, how many children they had, what they lost in the massacre. And through these seemingly mundane details, we get a picture of the lives that these people lived before the violence, right? So they're not simply defined by the violence that's visited upon them, but we get this kind of accounting of Black life that I think is really central to Wells's work. She's not simply somebody who, right, she's famously known for collecting and presenting us with the statistics on lynching, but she also gives us these kind of haunting narratives of the lives of people who suffer violence and dispossession. And I think that that's just as important to her work as the, you know, the sort of marshalling of statistical data that she's well known for.
What misconceptions about grief and activism does your book seek to challenge? Why do these misconceptions exist and persist?
So I think one of the misconceptions, or I guess one of the expectations that we have about activism that I'm trying to challenge in this book is this notion that that activists are these kind of heroic people which they are, right? But that in seeing them in this way, we often don't appreciate their full humanity. I think and we also, I think, kind of outsource, right, the kind of work that's needed to make democracy real to activists, rather than feeling like this is work that we all need to take up ourselves. And so part of what the book is trying to do is particularly saying, you know, we have this history in the United States of relying on Black people to do this work to challenge white supremacy. And we've come to expect them to be activists in this way, even as we don't necessarily want them to be leaders, right? We're not necessarily want them to become, you know, the people who shape, you know, U.S. politics, but we want them to do this other kind of labor. And so, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is this, you know, this Vogue cover of Stacey Abrams that was prior to the 2020 election, where it was like, can Stacey Abrams save U.S. democracy? And of course, it's, you know, in some ways you could say, you know, she did, you know, what she did in Georgia, along with other Black voting rights activists, was clearly very pivotal to the 2020 election. But why is that work necessary, right? This is the thing, like, as we laud that work as heroic, what we don't pay attention to is the fact that if we need to do that work just for democracy to semi-function as it should, that means that there's serious problems with U.S. democracy, right? So part of what I'm trying to challenge is this idea that, you know, when we, you know, we all remember these stories from, you know, on election nights. Oh, the people who stood in line for hours waiting to vote. And of course, that shows, you know, such enormous, you know, civic commitment. But at the same time, we need to ask, why were people standing in hours waiting to vote? That means there's something really wrong. And that's a sign of, you know, a serious deficit in U.S. democracy, rather than the way in which we usually think about it, which is to say, oh, look at this, the heroic way in which people are putting in all this work to exercise their right to vote.
What new light does your book shed on the history of Black protest?
So I think one of the things that the book is trying to do is to really challenge some of the ways in which the misremembering of the civil rights movement has come to constrain how we see Black protests today, right? So based on this kind of romantic narrative of the civil rights movement, where you had, right, of course, these heroic protesters who engaged in civil disobedience, even when they were violently attacked, and were able to prevail. I think there is this sense in retrospect, right, that there was this, they were entirely civil, and there were these clashes with the police at times, but that they were able to induce these moral transformations in the white public. And part of, I think, the way in which that misleads us is that that narrative misleads us is that we forget that actually Dr. King did not become, overwhelmingly popular until after he was assassinated, that the civil rights protesters were seen as radicals, that they were seen as agitators, that their demands were seen as untimely, right? And so part of what I think the book is trying to show is to say, when we compare, and the comparison is often to say, when we compare, contemporary Black protests to those iconic protests in the past, when we say you're not following the script of the civil rights movement, or you're not doing this the right way, or you're being too angry, or you're being, if you don't completely follow the tenets of civil disobedience, then you'll never be heard, is that we forget how contentious even the most peaceful Black protests are, right? So if you think about the ways in which people were extremely critical, some people were, of the protests by athletes who knelt at the national anthem, right? Nothing could be more peaceful. There was absolutely nothing violent about those. And yet they were also controversial. So part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to show how we have these very narrow and constrained accounts of what the actions that Black protesters can engage in order for them to be legible and to be seen as legitimate, and that this is really constraining Black politics, and also shows that we haven't allowed Black people to express themselves politically, the same range of political tactics and emotions that others are allowed to engage in.
What new perspectives are gleaned in this book regarding the history and legacy of lynching?
So one, I talk about lynching in chapter 3 of Black Grief, White Grievance, when I write about Ida B. Wells, who was, right, the premier anti-lynching activist of the late 19th, early 20th century. And one of the really interesting things that Wells did, she was a pioneer in using lynching photographs as part of anti-lynching activism. And this is really interesting because lynching photographs, of course, weren't taken in order to denounce lynching. They were taken as souvenirs, and they depict these often smiling, you know, white crowds with people of all ages, including women and children, who are surrounding these horribly mutilated Black people who were killed in these horrific ways. And when Wells goes on a tour abroad, she goes to the UK to denounce lynching. She says, you know, the European audiences didn't believe me. So she starts using the photographs to show, no, these things actually happened. But what's interesting about lynching photographs is that they then, you know, when the NAACP begins its own anti-lynching campaign, they kind of become, interchangeable, right? So you have this, the specificity of the victims kind of disappears, and what people focus on is the sort of actions of the white mob and the way in which that's deforming U.S. democracy. And so I think one of the things that it's important for us to grapple with in terms of this use of lynching photography is that it raises all kinds of questions about, you know, what are our expectations for how people are going to react to these depictions of atrocity, but also how do we tell these stories? How do we tell stories of suffering that we want people to empathize with and be moved to action without, you know, kind of losing sight of the humanity of the victims, right? Without just having them be, an example of somebody who suffered a harm, but how do we humanize them? And I think this is what this is where the history of lynching and of lynching activism holds really, I think, important lessons for us in that regard.
Can you explain figure 2.1 for us? How does it depict John Lewis?
Ah, yes, that's a really interesting one. So throughout the book, throughout Black Grief, White Grievance, I intersperse poetry and images, and part of that is a response to the way in which, as I said, loss has this affective and aesthetic dimension, and I really try to capture that by bringing in those artifacts, and that figure in particular is a cartoon that appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that shows John Lewis as the bridge, and he, you know, it shows his body, you know, as a bridge between these two kind of land formations, and on the side of one is a voting booth, and there are these stick figures who are essentially stepping over him to get to the voting booth. And of course, we all know the story of John Lewis and, you know, him getting beaten on the marches in Selma as a young activist, which is what the figure of him as the bridge is referencing. But I use this photograph in the book to again ask this question about whether we are taking a certain kind of political labor by Black people for granted and expecting them to make these heroic sacrifices on behalf of U.S. democracy, right? So this figure of John Lewis is this, right, this person that people are literally walking over to in order to exercise their right to vote, I think points to, I think, this way in which we expect a certain kind of heroism of Black people, and we take it for granted that they will make those enormous sacrifices on behalf of U.S. democracy, and don't always attend to the ways in which that means that we're not seeing them as fully human. you know, this is in the context of me also talking about the work of Daniel Allen, who argues that sacrifice is central to democracy. And so part of, she says, the way that democracy works is that we are always giving things up for others, because of course in democracy you can't always win, and so sometimes you lose and you have to accept that if the conditions were fair. But the problem comes in when it's the same people who keep losing over and over and who are expected to always lose well. And so that's part of what that figure, that image of Lewis, for me, points to, the fact that, you know, we take this kind of Black heroism for granted, and we expect it to be displayed in order to make U.S. democracy better, without necessarily, you know, wanting to have Black people as leaders, not necessarily wanting to embrace their political ideas, but we want this particular kind of labor from them.
Can you describe the history and legacy of African-American mourning traditions as they are presented in your book?
Absolutely. So as the Claudia Rankine statement that we were discussing earlier, that the condition of Black life is one of mourning, illustrates, the, you know, and as has been shown by a lot of important scholarship on African-American mourning traditions, that because of the constant nature of Black grief, that African-Americans have had to develop ways to grieve that enable people to continue on, right? So that one of the things that I talk about in the book is the ways in which Black mourning doesn't really fit into the sort of established psychoanalytical accounts. Because, for example, the sort of psychoanalytical model is, you know, you have to go through the stages of grief, and then eventually you move past it. And if you don't, then you're engaging in this kind of melancholia that's not really moving on. But how do you move on if you are confronted with constant losses, right? You can't move on if the loss is ongoing. So one of the things that I think is really important about thinking about how African-American mourning traditions is thinking about why this facility with mourning, why these kind of, you know, ways of not just focusing on death, but focusing on life, have had to be developed. And how do we honor those, the wisdom of that tradition without instrumentalizing it? Because this is one of the things that I critique in the book, that we often, right, look to Black or African-American mourning traditions as this kind of supplement for democracy, right? That African-Americans can provide this model for how to do mourning in a more productive way that doesn't lead us to the kind of problematic national mourning, such as the one that followed after 9/11, that then enables this kind of, exercise of imperial power abroad that has and such disastrous consequences, or that, you know, leads to, you know, the way in which Muslim U.S. citizens are really, mistreated in the wake of 9/11, right? That this kind of sense of the nation having suffered, right, an injury, and that we have to, and so then we have to respond in this way can lead to these very to the production of these really problematic forms of political mobilization. And so this is not to say that we don't have anything to learn or we shouldn't turn to the tradition to learn from it, but to say, how can we draw on it while also recognizing that the facility, right, with mourning represents in itself an ongoing loss, and that what we need to do is to try to minimize those losses, is to say, how do we get to a place where Black people don't have to mourn so much, right? Or so well, because they are constantly having to do it.
Who did you write this book for? Who do you consider your ideal reader or ideal readers? Who do you consider your imagined audience or audiences? Who were you trying to reach in writing this book?
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, of course, I'm an academic, so I guess I suppose my first readers are fellow political theorists and faculty and students and people in other disciplines who are interested in these questions. But I think beyond that, I would hope that folks outside the academy will read the book, will look at some of the ideas presented in the book, and we'll find that it resonates with their own analysis of the moment that we find ourselves in, and hopefully will help them think about, what is happening in U.S. democracy today. So I would say, you know, I hope that that a wide range of people will read the book, and that they will find that it helps them think through this moment of a very, very grave threats to U.S. democracy, and also this moment of racist backlash that we find ourselves in. And I also, you know, hope that that activists find that it is respectful and adequately tries to grapple with their experiences.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you tell us about where your time and attention have gone since completing this book? What have you been working on presently? What are you working on now? What are you working on next?
The dreaded "what's your next book" question. No, I'm just kidding. So there was what was going to be a chapter in this book that I ended up having to cut, that was looking at Confederate monuments, was looking at the question of what should we do about racist monuments, because I talk in the book about symbolic loss and thinking about why people become so energized by some of these changes that seem, you know, not terribly consequential, like whether or not a monument to a slave owner is removed, or somebody who fought on behalf of slavery. And so I've been thinking a lot about monuments, and I've been writing an article that looks at some of the inaugural moments of Confederate celebration in the United States, and thinking about them in a hemispheric sense, because I write about them in light of an essay by the Cuban intellectual Jose Martí, who in the 1880s is living in the United States and writes about them. So yes, I'm thinking about monuments and trying to think about the sort of wave of monument removal that followed, particularly these moments of racial confrontation, the racial justice protests of 2020, and thinking about the question of the kind of civic work that monuments do.
I wish you the very best of luck. That sounds amazing.
Thank you.
And thank you as well for your generosity, eloquence, and erudition as communicated to us in our dialogue today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciated the conversation and the thoughtful questions.
Thank you. As we bring today's dialogue to a close, I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, I have been in dialogue with Juliet Hooker. She is Royce Family Professor of Teaching Excellence in Political Science at Brown University. We have been discussing her newly published book, Black Grief, White Grievance, The Politics of Loss, published in Princeton by Princeton University Press, 2023. This has been the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Thank you very much. And Juliet, thank you for all your wisdom.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.